This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Friday, June 11th, 2021. I'm Caleb Brown. This week marks 50 years since the first newspaper articles revealing what would eventually become known as the Pentagon Papers. We're still feeling the effects of the Pentagon Papers and the jurisprudence they inspired. Cato's Julian Sanchez and Pat Eddington detail the enduring importance of the Pentagon Papers. Why should people make note of the Pentagon Papers and its aftermath?
Well, it still stands as arguably the most important First Amendment case in American history. And it also was really, I think, kind of the beginning of the end. In fact, it was the beginning of the end of the Nixon administration, because in the quest to go after former Marine Corps officer turned RAND analyst Daniel Ellsberg, Richard Nixon unleashed his hounds to go after Ellsberg and to try to get his actually order to break into his psychiatrist office and all the rest of that. And so that puts us on the road, essentially, to Watergate and Nixon's demise. So hugely consequential, not just because it affirmed the right of the press to publish classified material, but it gave us the ability ultimately to see just exactly how quickly and easily a president can self-destruct in pursuit of a whistleblower.
Why was the publication of this information so controversial, Julian?
Well, so what we now know is the Pentagon Papers, had the rather banal title of the report from the Office of the Secretary of Defense on the Vietnam war, and it was prepared as a history of the conflict in the late 60s to document for future policymakers, but really revealed the extent of deception of the American public across multiple presidential administrations, that the U.S. had been involved earlier in ways that had never been reported in the press in South Vietnam's internal affairs, that it had engaged in illegal bombings in Cambodia and Laos, even as Johnson was pledging on the campaign trail no wider war, plans were being made to, in fact, escalate the war in Vietnam. All these disclosures showed, I think, the extent to which the war had been deceptively prosecuted, and also the extent to which the United States was remaining in the war, largely as a face-saving exercise. And sort of listed the reasons to stay in at the very bottom. It was, well-contained China, and I suppose, there's some value to having a freer and happy life for the Vietnamese, but it was primarily the idea that it would be a humiliation for the United States to admit the defeat effectively, and so that was hugely significant. But also, of course, the sort of second order effect of understanding that the government had claimed the sort of dire national security interest. It had obviously illegally gone after Ellsberg by wiretapping his phones and breaking into a psychiatrist's office, but also gone after him in court, charging with espionage. It was because of those illicit activities, effectively, the charges were ultimately dismissed, having sort of so tainted the proceedings that the court tossed them. But also going after the New York Times, as Pat mentioned, attempting after the publication on June 13th, 1971, of the first New York Times article based on these documents that Ellsberg had photocopied in his office at RAND over a period of an extended period. The Nixon administration sought to bar any further articles based on that material, claiming again, some grave harm to national security might eventuate if this were permitted. I think it's pretty hard objectively to look at what we now know and say that was justified. It seems really that the underlying principles, this was in fact quite embarrassing to the government, and it was less an issue of a concrete harm to security and more question of not wanting that embarrassing information out and wanting to set a precedents that such a publication could be barred. And this is a pattern we've seen going back to the very origins of the state secrets privilege back in the early 50s. The first place we really get a firm legal foundation for what we now know as the state secrets privilege, allowing the government to effectively refuse to turn over information it would otherwise be obligated to in court, stretches to a case called U.S. v. Reynolds from 1953, where the widows of three civilians who had been killed in a military plane crash in Georgia sought to sue the government, and the government effectively was able to toss the suit, claiming that this would reveal information that was essential to national security, reveal the secret workings of military aircraft. The court essentially accepted this and said, okay, no, we find this privilege of the government to protect its national security secrets and tossed this lawsuit. And, looking at, it was only nearly 50 years later, around 2000, that the report from that case was released. And it's really very difficult to say there's anything in there that was, critical national security information. It was just that it demonstrated the negligence of the government in the incident. We've seen, I think, pretty consistently over time that while, of course, there are certain things the government does need to keep secret to sort of execute its legitimate function, its core functions of protecting its citizens, that this perhaps necessary privilege very often becomes a shield for embarrassing facts that governments wish to hide from their people.
Pat, speaking of embarrassing facts, the government has continued to engage in problematic behavior since the release of these documents now 50 years ago. What do we have access to? What are people able to evaluate for themselves that they might not otherwise be able to do had the Pentagon Papers not been published, had this very public fight not occurred?
Well, I think, to go back to something that, Julian just talked about, which is this whole Reynolds case from 1953, one of the problems that we face in terms of being able to actually get information out to the public is this kind of pro-national security judicial activism that gives us garbage rulings like the Reynolds case, right? I mean, government officials literally lied to the Supreme Court of the United States about why that plane crashed and what was actually so special about the plane. And there was nothing special about the plane except the lousy maintenance job they did. And they hid that not just from the families of the service members who died as a result, but they got themselves this magic hide anything you want to essentially from the public kind of capability that, even something like the Freedom of Information Act, which was actually passed 5 years before the Pentagon Papers case, even something like the Freedom of Information Act cannot actually penetrate. And I think it's worth noting that the ramifications essentially of trying to get information out that flowed from the president of the Pentagon Papers case is continuously under assault, and it's been under assault especially in the so-called War on Terror period in the post 9/11 period. We saw that first, of course, with what Chelsea Manning ultimately leaked to WikiLeaks, which was the Army H-64 Apache footage. Over the Baghdad, I believe it was the Baghdad area, showing the gunship crew actually murdering civilians and some journalists, I believe, who worked for Reuters at the time. And they slapped a secret classification on that tape and used the secrecy, essentially, to hide a war crime. And if we fast forward, essentially, to what Edward Snowden ultimately did in 2013, which was to expose the unconstitutional mass surveillance, among other things, being perpetrated by NSA and the Department of Justice. Again, all of this taking place under this rubric of secrecy, this shroud, essentially, that the government tries to draw over its activities. And I think one of the things that continues to just enrage me about it all is just how readily federal courts show deference to all of this. We had a ruling again coming out of the FISA court in May, and Julian, I know, has written on this, whereby, again, we learn that the FBI engaged in a fairly massive use of searches of the FISA Section 702 database to keep tabs on people in the absence of any kind of criminal predicate. And the FISA court, again, for at least the second time that we know of in the last 10 years, lets them get away with it. No one is sanctioned. No one loses their job. And I think this is what really causes an enormous amount of rage and frustration. But in terms of actual tools available to the public by itself, I think the Freedom of Information Act, and especially litigation, particularly in this age, really are the primary ones. You know, we have a Congress that is entirely too disengaged on these issues when they're not acting as a cheerleader for the persecution of people like Julian Assange and Edward Snowden. They're sitting back and basically doing nothing to address these issues. If you actually go back just quickly and kind of look at the difference between the reaction to Ellsberg and his revelations on the one hand and Snowden on the other, it's absolutely stark. It's absolutely stark. The number of hearings in Congress that were ultimately launched because of these revelations and they put us on the road to what would ultimately give us the Church and Watergate committees, all the rest of this massive activity of oversight and reform that took place between 1971 and 1978 stands in stark contrast to what happened in the wake of what Edward Snowden did in 2013. We had no meaningful public hearings by Congress on this issue, and we had people like then House Intelligence Committee Chairman Mike Rogers basically lying to the public, telling the public that Snowden had actually given information to the Russians, even though that was never alleged in the indictment that the Justice Department issued against him. So it's tough getting this stuff out. It's why having whistleblowers is so important. What we need are greater protections for whistleblowers, and we can get into that, I think, as we go forward here in this podcast.
Speaking of protections for whistleblowers, I can recall years ago, and I may have mentioned this to either of you, then U.S. Representative Mike Pence suggesting that reporters, and had filed legislation to that effect in some way, saying that reporters shouldn't be held liable for having published or received information that was classified.
And yet we have seen an aggressive effort on the part of first the Obama administration and to a degree the Trump administration to go after journalists, to target their communications, to try to uncover who their sources are and so on and so forth. So would a reporter shield law, which is essentially what you're talking about there, you know, would that be, I think, something that the Society of Professional Journalists and the investigative reporters and editors, would they welcome that? Yeah, absolutely they would. And I do think it's something that would be very helpful.
Julian, when these cases like this go to the U.S. Supreme Court, there is still a massive amount of deference that the court gives to broad assertions of national security.
Oh, that's absolutely right. And, you know, I was just thinking of the, this was pre-Snowden, but the first challenge to the kind of precursor legislation to what became Section 702 of FISA, the authority to effectively get general warrants for surveillance of foreign persons outside the U.S., including in communication with American citizens in the United States. And if you look at that decision now, Amnesty v. Clapper, a case where various civil society organizations challenged the legislation on the grounds that they were likely to be likely to have their communications swept up in the process, and that this violated their Fourth Amendment rights in the process. If you read that opinion now, there are a lot of factual assertions about how Section 702 surveillance worked that the court accepts that we now know post-Snowden are just not true or not correct. They asserted, for example, they make mention of this, so presumably the court thought this was relevant to their reasoning, that one would not be swept up in surveillance unless one were in direct communication with a foreign target. We now know that is not, in fact, how the system worked. They were engaged in something called abouts collection, meaning if you had a communication that mentioned the foreign target or an identifier like their email address, that could get you swept in as well. So the court effectively made a decision based on a misrepresentation and a misunderstanding of how the program worked. But I think, you know, Pat's point about the FISA court shows that, you know, apart from its deference on these sort of factual judgments, there is a kind of deference on equities questions. So, you know, courts look at various kinds of tests of compelling interest or grave harm when balancing interests and making decisions. There are, you know, in the abstract, of course, there is maybe no more compelling interest than the national security, you know, broadly construed. And the problem, of course, is that judges not being experts in the details of national security, not necessarily wanting to impose their own judgment over that of, you know, actual military experts, or what is the likelihood that some disclosure would in fact cause a grave security harm. And also, in a sense, I think a fear of perhaps being responsible if that harm occurs. You know, leads to a situation where almost any claim, however sort of facially implausible, is treated with incredible deference by the court. I think the Fisk opinion that the Pat referenced, you know, finding a lot of compliance issues and violations of procedure with respect to NSA surveillance, but nevertheless going ahead to authorize that bulk surveillance, you know, comes out of a culture where, and we know this from former FISA court judges, government lawyers do say things like, well, you'll have blood on your hands if you don't grant this authority to surveil this target. And the structure of that statute is that it's not just a single target you're authorizing or rejecting surveillance on, but literally hundreds of thousands of targets in a programmatic way. And so you've got, you know, the court in the position of having to decide, well, if I finds, as perhaps the evidence would indicate, that, you know, this program as a whole is very hard to find consistent with a prohibition on unreasonable searches and seizures of American communications, that you then shut down this entire thing, which, you know, may lead to the loss of valuable intelligence. I mean, there is genuinely useful intelligence collected via this authority. But, you know, it puts the thumb on the scales, I think, in a dangerous way. And we find, I think, the same thing to do with secrecy. The same kind of incentive operates both within the courts and within the military intelligence bureaucracies, right? No one has ever lost their job for classifying too much information. If you let something out that proves embarrassing or indeed genuinely harmful to national security, you'll certainly be accountable for that. But if you decide, you know, you'd better classify the softball schedule just in case, you know, you're not going to lose your job for that. And, you know, from the court's perspective, you know, they are more fearful of the risk of letting something out that is harmful than of keeping it secret, in part because if you keep it secret, no one can then point at you and say, hey, that didn't deserve to be secret at all. The public may assume that there is some good reason it's secret. But, you know, if you look at the history of documents that have been declassified over time, and you ask yourself, the standard for, you know, secret and top secret classifications is supposed to be, is this information that if disclosed would cause grave harm or exceptionally grave harm to the national security interest of the United States? I think you will be very hard pressed, you know, pick your favorite declassified document and ask yourself, is it plausible that every part of this would, if disclosed, cause grave harm to the national security of the United States? That is the formal standard, but I don't think any reasonable person believes it is the standard in practice.
Okay, so Pat, we want embarrassing failures of our own government that do not implicate national security to come to light. And the Pentagon Papers certainly presented us an opportunity to essentially protect people who bring that kind of information to light. But as Julian said, there are legitimate cases where the government needs to keep things secret for the purposes of executing on its promise of delivering national security.
I think we have to make some distinctions between that which is legitimately classified to actually protect a completely perishable source and method, for example, versus misusing deliberately and with malice aforethought, misusing the classification system to conceal waste, fraud, abuse, misconduct, and even criminal conduct and things that embarrass the government. And although we have an executive order that explicitly prohibits that activity, Executive Order 13526, which is the one that governs the use of the classification system, it's just that. It's an executive order. It is not statute. And there, to the best of my knowledge, has never actually been an investigation of any individual who's engaged in overclassification for the purpose of concealing the very kinds of misconduct and problems that we've been talking about. And I think, you know, to kind of go back to what Julian harped on very nicely there, is this whole issue of judicial deference and the fear of being wrong. I would think that after the history of the last 50 years of the so-called national security state, we ought to be doing a much better job in our law schools of teaching folks, hey, this is when they lied, this is how they lied, this is the pattern and practice of their lying. If you get on the federal bench, you know, don't take their word for it. And if you're concerned as a judge, you have the authority to retain what's known as a special master, essentially an independent arbiter who can assist you in evaluating whether or not these claims are credible. And in fact, one of the few useful things that I saw in USA Freedom Act that was passed in 2015 was the creation of this kind of overall capabilities. One of the very few times I've actually seen it put in statute in connection with any kind of national security related activity. I think it ought to be mandatory in the same way that I believe that it ought to be mandatory for every judge to have to conduct in-camera reviews in FOIA cases every time the government makes a B1 or national security related assertion. You know, if material is 25 years old or older, it's subject to mandatory declassification review anyway. So we really need to have a fundamental sea change in mentality and culture. And you would think that in the 50 years since Daniel Ellsberg did what he did, we would have had enough folks go through successive Congresses, and we would have had enough folks pass through the federal judiciary that they would have learned that your job is not to take the word of the executive branch. Your job is to oversee the executive branch and make sure that they're not abusing this authority and this power. But we just don't have that. And I have to point out that our colleagues on the criminal justice team just last week published this devastating report on exactly how radically out of balance the federal judiciary is in terms of the number of former prosecutors who have become judges. I mean, it is absolutely astounding the imbalance that we have here. So it helps, I think it really helps to explain in so many ways why we see this deferential attitude on the part of federal judges. That's because so many of them are former prosecutors. And so they're going to give the benefit of the doubt to the government and makes it impossible in many cases to actually get what I would really consider to be a genuinely fair, impartial hearing on the claims of the parties involved in these kinds of cases.
Julian Sanchez is a senior fellow at the Cato Institute. Pat Eddington is a research fellow at Cato. Subscribe to the Cato Daily Podcast pretty much anywhere and follow us on Twitter @CatoPodcast.